The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Great to see you. I was going to say on this cold winter's morning, but it's not cold, is it? Beautiful weather. You've no doubt heard the proverbial statement, the wisdom of Solomon. And it'd be great to have access to wisdom as we live our lives. Well, the good news is, in your hands, that A4 sheet is a part of the book of Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament of the Bible. And Ecclesiastes claims to be exactly that, the wisdom of Solomon. So if you look at how the book starts, the words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. King Solomon was the son of David around 950 BC. He's the patron of the wisdom literature in the Old Testament. And so Solomon writes this, or it's written through the eyes of Solomon. He writes and looks at the world, as he says, under the sun. If you've been here the last 5 weeks as we work through the book, when he says under the sun, he means just if you look out at the world, what do you see? If you don't have a kind of a revelation from God, how do you make sense of the world? And the thesis he's pushing is the idea that nothing lasts. Everything is ephemeral or fleeting. The Hebrew word he uses is hebel. I thought I'd give you a scholarly definition. I've given you 5 weeks of definitions of my rough. Here we are from Rachel Doolin. She says this: Hebel is a breath, a vapor, a substance that is unseen yet experienced, short-lived yet ephemeral. As such, Hebel represents all that is fleeting. Life is Hebel. Now, the New International Version translation that you're holding in your hand has gone, it's very hard to translate the word Hebel into English. They've gone for the word meaningless. And you can kind of see why. The Hebel idea is a metaphor for something that just doesn't last. So Solomon says, chapter 1, verse 2, meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. He's saying all of life is fleeting, nothing lasts. And so what we've seen is we've worked through 12 chapters, he'll go and look at all sorts of different things in life, and the test is, do they last? Chapter 2, pleasure is good, it's fun, but it doesn't last. Chapter 2, achievement doesn't last. Wisdom is Hebel. Work, at the end of chapter 2, envy, political popularity, satisfaction through money, etc., runs right the way through. Nothing lasts. Everything is fleeting, ephemeral. Now, that's one theme. Nothing lasts. Nothing's permanent. The other theme that runs through it, well, if that's what there is, try and enjoy it anyway. So the other theme that comes up, where are we? Here we are. The other theme is this: enjoy it if you can. So last week in chapter 9, you may remember he says to this, if this is all there is under the sun, go eat your food with gladness and drink your wine with a joyful heart, for God has already approved what you do. Always be clothed in white, always anoint your head with oil. In other words, you wear white when you're at a party, not working. Enjoy life with your wife whom you love, all the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun, all your meaningless days, for this is your lot in life and your toilsome labour under the sun. Hey, it doesn't last, but enjoy it if you can. Now, those two themes that run through the book, and I hope I might motivate you to read the 12 chapters of Ecclesiastes. It doesn't last, it's all ephemeral, but enjoy it if you can. Those two themes come together at the end of the book in chapter 11, where he talks about youth and old age. And so have a look at chapter 11, verse 9. It's there printed on your sheet. It's a word to the young. And as I look around, there's some in the audience. We're using live ammunition. Some of you are still young. Look at verse 9. You who are young, be happy while you are young, and let your joy in the day of your youth. Follow the ways of your heart, and whatever your eyes see. What's he saying? Enjoy your youth. Enjoy it. There are so many good things about being young. Passions, new experiences. You can learn new things. Your memory actually works. You're able to learn new things. You can stay up all night if you want to, or past 9:30 anyway. You can sleep in if you want to, past 5 a.m. There's little things you should enjoy, like hair grows where you want it to instead of out of your ears. You can eat whatever food you want and not worry about it. You can pick up a barbell and get stronger. You can put on your running shoes and get faster. You can learn to surf or play a musical instrument or do some travelling or go to concerts or music festivals. And you can dance and have fun and fall in love and laugh and all sorts of things. So if you're young, enjoy it. But Ecclesiastes, see, we live in a society that not just appreciates youth, pretty much worships youth. But Ecclesiastes here has some wisdom in two different ways. We should all listen, but particularly you young guys, okay, young men and women. Look at the two different ways. You see, the first way is in the second half of verse 9. Youth is so good and so special and so wonderful, God will hold us accountable for it. You who are young, see the middle of verse 9, follow the ways of your heart and whatever your eyes see, but know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. That's not to spoil the fun, it's not to take the edge, it's saying this is precious and God will hold you accountable for how you use your energy and your potential and so on. So that's one. The second wisdom is this: when it's gone, understand that it's gone and accept that it doesn't last. See verse 10. So then, banish anxiety from your heart and cast off the troubles of your body, for youth and vigour are meaningless. And the meaningless word, remember, he's not saying it's bad. Meaningless, the Hebel word, it doesn't last. He's saying, so enjoy it while it's here, but youth and vigour, being young, it doesn't last. It'll fade away. Actually, literally, the vigour word there is interesting. It means blackness of hair. It's a funny, it's an idiom. Meaning, in that culture, when your hair is jet black, before you could change the colour, etc., you were still young and vigorous. When you were grey, or your hair fell out, not so young. The wisdom is understanding there's seasons in life. If you were here when we looked at Ecclesiastes chapter 3, talked about there's a season for this and a season for that, time to be born, and etc. There's a season when you're young and you're beautiful and vigorous, and then there's a season when you're not. And if you can't accept that, life gets messed up. My dear old mother used to talk about mutton dressed up as lamb, if you understand the context. I could say 1,000 words about this. One picture is worth more. There you go. I don't know if you can see that. That is 38 years ago, 31st of January, 1981. As Kathy and I leave our wedding reception. If you know Kathy, you can see that the years have been much kinder to her than to me. But youth has gone. Now, accept that? Sure. We're grandparents now. It's our mission to be a good popo and gung gung. And tomorrow we'll drive down to Canberra and see a couple of grandkids, and that will be fun. But when it's gone, it's gone. That's the wisdom of understanding it. But there is something that all of us should remember. You see chapter 12, verse 1. He says this: remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come, when the years approach, when you will say, I find no pleasure in them. Now, what does he mean? Well, he's about to give us a poem. It's an extended metaphor. I'll read it. You'll get the vibe. Here he goes. Verse 2. Why remember your Creator? Verse 2, before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars grow dark and the clouds return after the rain. When the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men stoop, when the grinders cease because they are few and those looking through the windows grow dim, when the doors to the street are closed and the sound of grinding fades, when people rise up at the sound of birds but all their songs grow faint, when people are afraid of heights and of dangers in the streets, when the almond tree blossoms and the grasshopper drags itself along and desire no longer is stirred and people go to their eternal home and mourners go about the streets. Well, obviously it's a poem about old age, and old age likened in some ways to a house. The idea of clouds that return after the rain, the dark times that are coming. The keepers that tremble, I'm assuming hands that shake if you watch the elderly. The strong men stoop, probably the legs that grow weak. Those looking through the windows grow dim. All of us who wear glasses understand that. And, well, in those days they didn't have the glasses, so the eyes certainly grew dim. The grinders, a few. You know, the teeth fall out or lose. You lose them. The fear of going out in the street. The almond blossom, the silver hair turning grey. The grasshopper drags itself along. It's probably the laboured walk of the elderly with the walking stick. Desire is no longer stirred. Well, you can fill in the gaps there. I remember when I was a kid, I would do jobs for these two dear, sweet old maiden aunts. They were in their 80s. They were unmarried. They were both very elderly. And it was funny, they were sweet old things, but I could never imagine being like them. I could never imagine being that old. It was like they were from another planet. And yet, whether you're 20, 40, 60 or 80, it's still the same you inside. And folks, we cannot beat time and gravity. You can have the most perfect body ever built. If you're listening on the recording, here's a picture of Arnold Schwarzenegger in his prime. I don't know how many times he was Mr. Universe, Mr. Olympia, 8 times, greatest bodybuilder ever, but even Arnold could not beat time and gravity. None of us will. So why is it that we grow old? Can we avoid it? Can we ultimately avoid death? Yuval Noah Harari is a professor of history at Jerusalem University. A very clever man, and he wrote Sapiens, which was a New York Times bestseller, and then the follow-up, Homo Deus, the God-Man. Sapiens is the better book. He writes as an atheist, and he writes for the worldview that, if you like, that's under the sun. But he says this about death and facing death. Modern science and modern culture have an entirely different take on life and death, comparing science to the old religions. Rather, for modern people, death is a technical problem that we can and should solve. So science will one day take care of death. We won't have to die. Now, maybe you might like to be like Dr. James Bedford. In 1967, Dr. James Bedford was the first person to be cryonically frozen. The idea being that Dr. Bedford's been snap frozen, and when we conquer death, we'll microwave him, and he'll be able to live again. He's currently stored at the Alcor Life Extension Foundation. Okay. However, in his second volume, Homo Deus, the God-Man, Professor Harari gets a little bit closer to reality, shall we say, where he says this. In truth, so far, modern medicine hasn't extended natural lifespan by a single year. Its great achievement has been to save us from premature death and allow us to enjoy the full measure of our years. Even if we now overcome cancer, diabetes and other major killers, it would mean only that almost everyone will get to live to 90. But it would not be enough to reach 150, let alone 500. Imagine how much super you'd need if you're going to live to 500. Anyway, now, here's my question. Would you want to live to 150? There's a man called Quentin Crisp. I don't know if you'd heard of him. He's 50 years ago or more. He was, how would you put it, an entertainer, a writer, a provocateur. A little bit like the 20th century's version of Milo Yiannopoulos, if you know who he is. He was a public atheist, and when he was an old man, there was a scientific, the scientific breakthrough proposed that people would be able to live to be 130 years old. Here's what Quentin Crisp wrote in response to the promise of living to 130. He said this: "I am 90 years old. The advantage of being 90 is that you can look forward to death. The world is getting noisier, sexier and more horrible by the minute, but at least I can comfort myself with the fact that the end is in sight." Or so I thought. Imagine my horror when I opened the newspaper to discover that they were going to make us live to 130. When you're 60 or 70, the thought of death crosses your mind like a shadow. It disturbs you, it worries you, and by the time you reach my age, you're longing for it. My body is dying on me. I carry it like an old overcoat. It's horrible. You start to smell the smell of death, and you can do nothing about it. I can no longer see properly. I need to wear glasses when I go out, but I'm far too vain, so I walk the streets blind. You go deaf, and people talk to you as if you're a non-comprehending child. Your legs give up on you. Nowadays, I spend so much time working out how to avoid making the trip downstairs more than once a day. And when I do go out, I can barely walk more than a few metres at a snail's pace. And according to those who know, I'm lucky. I'm in good shape for my 90 years. This isn't a world for old people. Every few minutes there are adverts on the television telling you how to keep the lines from your face. When you're 90, you have lines all over your body, never mind your face. There's no work for old people. Why would we spend 65 years or more in retirement, remembering a time when we were useful? Everything today is geared towards the young. There's a terrible feeling of exclusion, even for moderately old people. Where would we hide when we were 130? We'd become the disappeared. Just think of the gadgets we'd need. Every house with an elevator. But the world will be so much wiser, say the optimists. I'm afraid that's an illusion. As we get older, we lose our wisdom, our mind, our language. We would have a world in which no one could communicate because we'd have forgotten how to. No, the absolute nothingness of death is a blessing, something to look forward to. If I discovered a potion to make people live until 130, the first thing I'd do is to bury it. I think it's a very hard thing to face old age, ultimately in death, without hope. And here's a man who lived under the sun and so lived without hope. Do you remember 2 days before the federal election, 16th of May, our former Prime Minister, Mr. Bob Hawke, died? What I thought was interesting, or what I noticed, was as his wife Blanche announced that Mr. Hawke had died, she said this: "He was dearly loved by his family and so many friends and colleagues. We will miss him. The golden bowl is broken. The golden bowl is broken." And that little phrase made me pick up, why did she say that? Well, I wonder whether it's linked to the fact that Mr. Hawke was the son of a Congregationalist minister, grew up in South Australia in a clergy home. Where does that phrase come from? Have a look at Ecclesiastes chapter 6. "Remember him before the silver cord is severed and the golden bowl is broken." "Remember him before the silver cord is severed and the golden bowl is broken, before shattered at the string and the wheel broken at the well." They're all just metaphors of something precious that holds something precious and is broken beyond repair. The silver cord, the golden bowl, the pitcher, they're all analogies of death and something that can't be fixed, can't be remade. Verse 7, "And the dust returns to the ground it came from, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Meaningless, meaningless," says the teacher, "everything is meaningless." See, why is our world hebel, ephemeral, fleeting? The answer is because we are. And so you get to the end of the main part of the book, chapter 12, verse 8, the end of the argument, if you like, and he says, "Meaningless, meaningless, hebel, hebel," says the teacher, "everything is meaningless." And so where did he start? Chapter 1, verse 2, exactly the same place, the beginning. "Meaningless, meaningless," says the teacher, "utterly meaningless." And those two statements are bookends in the way, the structure of the book. They hold the argument together. That's his point, that nothing lasts under the sun, if this is all there is. Nothing is permanent. Why? Because we don't last. Now, it's the epilogue of the book that actually is the key that changes everything. The epilogue in some ways is the key to understanding the whole argument of the book. And that's just tacked on, that's welded on at chapter 12, verse 9. Let me read that for you and you see how everything changes. It's deliberately written in the third person to give you a slightly different perspective. He says, "Not only was the teacher wise, but he also imparted knowledge to the people. He pondered and searched out and set in order many proverbs. The teacher searched to find just the right words, and what he wrote was upright and true." So much thought has gone into this. Verse 11, "The words of the wise are like goads, their collected sayings like firmly embedded nails given by one shepherd." A goad was simply a stick with a point on it that you jabbed the ox with to make it pull the plough. The idea being these words are meant to jab us, to move us, to make us think. and the nails something to hang on to, anchor points. Verse 12, be warned, my son, of anything in addition to them, of making many books there is no end, and much study wearies the body. That's true. I think it's meant to be encouragement to those who face the HSC, an MBA, a PhD, or what other acronym you're studying. But I think it's more than that. It's the idea that for some people, there's endless study, endless reading, endless thinking, but the time comes when you actually have to make a decision, like verse 13. Now, all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the duty of all mankind. Now, there's his answer. His point being, we don't just live meaningless lives under the sun. We have a purpose. There is a purpose that humanity is created for, each individual, and that is to know our Creator. To fear God, as he says. Fear God doesn't mean blind terror. It means to actually take God, your Creator, very seriously. To listen to him. And you notice what he says, to keep his commandments. In 12 chapters, that's the first time he's ever mentioned that God has spoken to us. And God had spoken in Solomon's day through the prophets in Israel, has told Israel how they should live. Why? Because God is good and wise and wants us to enjoy life. And the whole duty of humanity is to know and to serve and enjoy our Creator and to find peace and purpose as we do that. And it's because God cares that he'll hold us accountable. You see verse 14, for God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. That God will judge us according to what we've done, and he understands our motives and the hidden agendas in our hearts. And all of a sudden, if you want meaning in life, there's probably more than enough meaning. Life is not Hebel and meaningless. What we do matters, and ultimately will be judged. And as Russell Crowe in his Academy Award winning performance said, what we do in life echoes in eternity. I'd say actually eternity crackles like electricity in the present when you understand that. And so judgment day and eternity, with God or without God, there's meaning in how we live. Right, now, let me ask you folks, if you've been here the last 6 weeks or if you're just new to this, are you impressed with the wisdom of Solomon? Like, this is written between 2,000 and 3,000 years ago, and I'm always amazed with Ecclesiastes how it crosses cultures and how it crosses the centuries. Just speaks to us today, to our world. And so we should listen. Now, in Solomon's own day, Solomon was, how would we put it? Solomon was a big deal in his own day. His fame spread. And so it spread way down south to the Queen of Sheba. And there's an artist's impression of the Queen of Sheba. She's the one on the left. Where exactly was she from? Well, Sheba, sometimes she's called the Queen of Sheba, sometimes the Queen of the South. There's debate about whether she was from... she was from Yemen at the base of the Arabian Peninsula or Ethiopia, just across the strait there in the northern part of Africa. Either way, when she travelled to see Solomon, was around 2,200 kilometres, probably on a camel, which shows some motivation. Here's a beautiful painting, The Visit of the Queen of Sheba to King Solomon by Edward Poynter, painted in 1890, and if you'd like to see the real thing, it's in the Art Gallery of New South Wales. We have the original. She arrived because she'd heard of Solomon and his wisdom and his riches, and she came to check it out. In 1 Kings chapter 10, one of the history books of the Old Testament, we're told, when the Queen of Sheba heard about the fame of Solomon and his relationship to the Lord, she came to test Solomon with hard questions. At the end of it, she says, I'd heard great things, but I'd only heard half of what was actually happening, how wise you were, how rich you were, and she goes home a believer and follower of the God of Israel. Now, you haven't travelled 2,000 kilometres on a camel, but you've turned up early on a Thursday morning to listen to the wisdom of Solomon. Well done. Well done. The bad news is this. Solomon's wisdom isn't enough. There you go. Solomon's wisdom isn't enough. Why? He says, keep God's commandments because God will judge you. I don't keep God's commandments properly. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind and strength. I don't do that. Love your neighbour as yourself. I know that is right, but I don't keep that properly. It's hard enough to list the Ten Commandments, let alone keep them. So that's the bad news. We will all fail the judgment day. That's the bad news. The good news is this. Someone greater than Solomon is here. Someone greater than Solomon is here. So about 1,000 years after Solomon, in the same country, as a young Jewish rabbi stands, or a teacher stands up, and what is it that Jesus says? As he speaks to a generation that wouldn't listen to him, that ultimately wouldn't believe in him, he says this in Luke chapter 11, verse 31. The queen of the south, Queen of Sheba, will rise at the judgment with the people of this generation and condemn them. Why? For she came from the ends of the earth to listen to Solomon's wisdom, and now something greater than Solomon is here. Now, how is Jesus greater than Solomon? Well, in many, many ways. But let me just give you two. The first one is this. Solomon told us that God would judge us one day. Jesus says he himself is that judge. So the Apostle Paul says in when he writes to the Corinthians, 2 Corinthians 5:10, for we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ so that each of us may receive what is due us for the things done while in the body, whether good or bad. Jesus says he is the judge. He is the one who will judge us for how we've responded to God, how we've treated other people, etc. Remember I said we don't live up to our own standards, let alone God's. The good news is the second way that Jesus is greater, Solomon could show us our problem, Jesus could answer it and deal with it. So Jesus says in Mark chapter 10, for even the Son of Man, his way of speaking about himself, the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus came actually to pay the price of forgiveness for how I fall short, how you fall short, so that we might be forgiven and have the promise of eternal life. Now, let's come to the end of Ecclesiastes. We don't live meaningless lives just under the sun. God has spoken to us. He has spoken to us particularly in the person of Jesus and the offer of forgiveness and eternal life. But not only does that change eternity, it actually changes life now. Because what Ecclesiastes is written for particularly is to stop us investing our lives in things under the sun that won't hold the weight. If we make money and wealth and possessions the meaning of our life, it'll never quite satisfy. Once you understand that just a good gift of God and not the meaning of life, then we can relax and be generous with stuff. Our work. If we understand our work's not the meaning of life, it won't ultimately deliver, but it's good, and if we can enjoy it, that's great. Pleasure or lifestyle is good, but it won't last, so we can enjoy it and understand that it won't ultimately last. And youth and beauty, enjoy it while you've got it, because it's going to fade away one day, but that's okay. And once we understand that God's in control, we can learn contentment rather than envy and frustration. So what Ecclesiastes will do, and the reason I love this little book is this, it actually reverses the value system of our world. So what really matters? Well, climb the ladder, make a whole lot of money, be famous. No, no, no. What really matters is this. How have I responded to God, my creator? Have I honoured and thanked him? How have I treated other people and how have I cared for them? And the fundamental question, of course, how have I responded to God's offer of forgiveness and friendship in the person of Jesus? All right, as usual, excellent questions. How hard should Christians take steps to attempt to postpone the ultimately effects of aging, e.g. exercise, moderate eating, etc.? I think there's a balance between trying to look after yourself and stay fit and healthy, and then also understanding the fact that, you know, you're not 18 years old anymore. In 1 Timothy chapter 4, the Apostle Paul says physical training is of some value. And so, yeah, good to stay, as you're able, to stay fit and healthy, etc. There's also a balance there that, you know, your fitness and all that sort of thing, don't make that the meaning of life. Why? It's good, but it's going to fade away. He does say in the second half of that verse, physical training is of some value. Training in godliness is of value in all things. In other words, walking with God and learning to be more like Jesus is the thing of ultimate value. So, yeah, it's good to exercise, moderate eating, that sort of thing. I think it's wise to look after ourselves. Is there a time before death for we aged or aging to give up? I think the Bible would call us to accept that our life, the time of our life and the time of our death is in the hands of God. There's also a misunderstanding in the euthanasia debate, and that is, I think for Christians, it is perfectly acceptable to stop artificial treatment that is artificially keeping someone alive. So there's a significant difference between taking active steps to kill someone, euthanasia, and then stopping treatment that is artificially keeping someone alive. Is there a time before death to give, if that's what the question means? Growing old and getting to the end of life is not easy. I've watched my wife Kathy care for her father and her mother over the last 4 or 5 years, and Kathy's dad died last year at 95, I think, just before, or 96, and the last couple of years were very difficult for him, that he had trouble walking and moving around, that kind of thing. It is not easy. I think what Ecclesiastes is telling us is also it's a very difficult thing to live under the sun without hope and also to face that. How should we understand verse 7? I'm assuming that's 12 verse 7. Does it tell us anything of what happens to us immediately after death? It's interesting, the Bible writers, and you move to the New Testament, the Bible writers don't tell us a lot about what happens to people between when they die and the return of Jesus and the judgment day. As best I can think, that is, those who belong to Jesus, who follow him, will be, the Apostle Paul says in Philippians chapter 1, to be with the Lord, and it will be good. In 2 Corinthians, the second letter to the Corinthians in chapter 5, he talks about the idea of being spiritually with God and yet not physical. The end point for those who follow Jesus is to be like him, And so the Bible does talk about soul or spirit and body, but the promise of eternity is not disembodied spirits floating around, it's actually to be resurrected and to be in a body fit for eternity. That's the promise. I think what the Bible is saying, for those who die without a trust in Jesus, they will wait until Jesus' return and the judgment day. But the Bible does talk about both those who believe and those who don't being raised again. In John chapter 5, Jesus says everyone will be raised. Some will be raised to a resurrection of life and some raised to a resurrection of judgment. If that's all too much too quick, just come and ask me. I can give you some of those references if you want to look them up. But the idea of now, for those who are with Jesus, to die and be, quote, with the Lord, and it'll be good. 1 Corinthians, verse 12, 14, why are good deeds judged? Yeah, if you have a look at the Apostle Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5, verse 10, we'll all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so each may receive what is due for us, things while done in the body, whether good or bad, will be judged. And Jesus promises for those who have trusted him, and because they trusted him, they've served him and acted, there will be rewards. He's not at all sheepish about talking about rewards. Matthew 25, parable of the talents, the Apostle Paul talks about it again and again. But I don't think the reward will be that that you'll get a bigger room in heaven, or you'll get a Mercedes instead of a Toyota, or more money to spend or whatever. I think the reward will be that you will see, if you've served Jesus and invested your life in others and serving him, you will see the value of what you have done, and it will have eternal value. I think that will be the key to the reward. So yeah, good deeds judged as well. And Jesus does say, for those who have served him, and because they trusted him, the great reward will be being told, well done, good and faithful servant. You'll find that in the parable of the talents. It's Matthew 25. How does 12 verse 7, and the spirit returns to God who gave it, fit in with the bodily resurrection? Well, I've just talked about that. I think that's the idea. You find that as the Apostle writes, Philippians chapter 1, and it's in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, the idea of the spirit, our spirit, who we are, our consciousness will be with God or with the Lord, and then as he returns, the promise of the resurrection, being raised to be like Jesus. Why do Christians believe that? Well, it's actually anchored in the resurrection of Jesus. And I think the evidence for him that Jesus did rise truly in history, etc., is very strong. All right. One last question. Okay. Noting Ecclesiastes 11, verse 10. So then banish anxiety from your heart, cast off the troubles. And the reference to anxiety, how much of the modern youth's fragility is due to the loss of Christian faith? I'll just read the question. The snowflake's inability to put setbacks into perspective. It's Simon Sinek's got a YouTube clip about millennials. And how older generations have not done the millennials any favours in the expectations or the world that they've inherited. It's very interesting. I can't remember. Anyone remember the? It's about 15 minutes. Simon Sinek on. No, oh, I've seen it. I can't remember it. There's a negative and there's a positive. I don't think you can just say modern youth are fragile. You just can't. You know, there's millions of them. You can't make a generalised statement. What I do notice is there's a lot of the young ones that I know are working very hard and very long hours and are very motivated in what they're doing. But I think what has happened over the last couple of generations is as our society has become more and more secular, in other words, very much like just living under the sun, there is a loss of hope in the future and a growing cynicism about what used to be the foundations of our society, the institutions. You can just pick the loss of faith in the banks, in the government, in the media, and I must say in the church, inverted commas, as well. And so there is a loss of hope. I also noticed, more as I said last week, suicide has become more and more of an issue. The biggest killer of people 18 to 44 in our society by a mile, by a factor of three or four, and by a factor of two or three, is suicide. And it's got to be linked. I'm not speaking for any individual, but it's got to be linked to a loss of hope, etc. And so. I think that's certainly an issue. Resilience, I'd like to think a little more about that one. It varies a lot from person to person. Ecclesiastes 12 is not all this emphasis on your physical decline, a sense of despair. Are not Christians required to just keep going? Yes, that's the point of the whole book. He's saying, if you just live under the sun, if this is all there is, ultimately you do end up in a point of despair. So the whole thing is an argument. He starts at chapter 1, verse 2, saying the world appears to be ephemeral and hence nothing lasts, and so what's the point? And that's the next, right? And after 12 chapters of argument, he's showing you that pretty much that everything he's looked at, including us, doesn't last. Then he says, if you really want to find something that lasts and has meaning, fear God, keep his commandments, because he has spoken to us, and there is a judgment day. That's the flow of the book. And so, yes, the Christian's required to just keep going. Why? Because the New Testament is written to people who were suffering, people who faced difficulties, persecution, etc. And the New Testament doesn't give easy answers. What the New Testament gives is hope. Hope. You're facing persecution? Hope one day that there'll be justice and Jesus will return. You're facing sickness and so on? Hope that one day there'll be no more mourning or crying or pain, etc. That's the point of the whole book. All right. And that's also the end of me.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.